Hello and welcome once again to my new favorite thing I get to do. It's my little spin-off podcast called Breakfast All Day, A La Carte. It's my interviews with my friends and folks who work in film and television who are just interesting and cool in general. And the person sitting across from me today fulfills all of those requirements.
You're so kind.
It's true. Her name is Kieran Giovanni, and she is a longtime actress, singer, dancer, Broadway musical extravaganza.
That just makes me seem old.
You're not, though. You're so young. You've done so much with such a young age.
I started very young. No.
You did. So I'm really happy to see you.
I'm happy to see you.
Yes, it's been too long, although you live like five blocks away from me.
Literally, my GPS, I put it in there, and it said 3.5 minutes.
You could have walked here.
I could have walked here.
But we live in L.A.
Well, I'm afraid if I walk around, people will think something's wrong with me. Like, that happened when I first moved here. I was walking, like, down this, we were looking for houses, and I was walking in Beverly Hills, but, like, through a really busy intersection, like San Vicente or something, and someone rolled down their window, and they're like, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm walking." Oh, wow. All right. Learn something new every day.
Right. It's like the song goes.
Yeah.
Nobody walks in L.A. So you may know Kieran best these days as Cutter, the badass assassin tracker on Black Lightning, which just had its season 2 finale. But she was also on TNT's Major Crimes for 6 seasons as, were you Lieutenant Amy Sykes?
Detective.
Detective Amy Sykes.
Yeah.
And you've done just a ton of varied work. We're going to talk about all of that.
Okay.
Is that cool?
That sounds cool.
All right. First of all, how do I know you?
Our kids went to preschool together, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So Nick and my little one, Peyton, started together at Hollywood Schoolhouse. Mm-hmm. Gosh, they're so old now.
It was 7 years ago.
Yeah, 7 years ago.
It was right about now, 7 years ago, that I met you.
That's so funny.
And this is such an L.A. private school thing, but they had, like, orientation. They had, like, 6 weeks of orientation before we even began, and that's how I met you, because you were in the same, like, Tuesday morning group with me or whatever day it was.
Yeah, they, like, made you stay until your kids could separate. Unfortunately, my kid was like, bye, see you later.
Same.
I'm good. So I got to step out of there early. But yeah, I totally remember that.
Yeah. So I remember watching Peyton. She was a big kid already at age 2.5 because she has an older sister.
Yep.
And so, like, when they're watching, can your kid, you know, hold a pencil or, like, eat with a fork? She's like, I got this. She had no time to play. She's like, what are you staring at me for?
She's still that kid.
I can do this.
Except for now she's like, can I drive the car? I'm like, no, you're 8. But
Very soon.
Soon enough.
Yeah, so our kids went to preschool together, and they were together for a couple of years there, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we were there for, what, 2 years with Peyton?
We were there for 3, and then now we've all left to different places that are of good fit for us now.
Right, right. That's a very LA thing to say. You know, it just really wasn't the right fit. And we just really looked elsewhere. So LA.
Yes. And so you've done the whole, like, looking at LA private schools thing. And so you know.
Yep. Oh, yeah. We've done all the things.
All the cliches are true.
Oh, my God. We've done them all. I can't believe it. Yes. I caved.
Yes. So, but what was fascinating about you when I first met you, you were so, and you still are, so down to earth about how amazing you are. Because I asked you, you had just moved to LA from New York, and I had asked you what you had come out here for, and you were very low key about it. You're like, oh, I got a job here, and didn't really want to say at first what it was. Like, you were really cool about it.
I guess, like, overhearing conversations for years where people are like, oh, well, I'm doing this and I'm doing this and I'm doing this. And I just didn't want to be that person. And also, like, when I see people that may or may not recognize me or whatever, I never want to assume it's because I was on TV. Because, I mean, what an assumption. Like, oh, you must be watching me. Oh, you must be a fan. Oh, you must know what I do. Because, to be honest, like, if you're a doctor or a radio host or a critic or whatever, like, your job's pretty cool if you love your job. I happen to love my job. I love what I do. So, I don't know. I just didn't want to make it, like, a thing. Well,
but, but there are people who have accomplished way less in their lives who are total assholes about it. And so I've always appreciated how, like, down to earth and grounded you always are.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I feel like I'm still, like, on the train. So I don't know. I haven't, it's not, you know, I'm old, but I'm young. I mean, I'm 36 years old. God, that's so hard to say.
Oh my God.
And I just feel like I have so much more that I want to do. So it's like a step. They're all little steps. Mm-hmm. So,
well, let's start from the beginning, the baby steps. You were born in Louisiana.
I was born in Louisiana.
Yes.
On a farm, actually.
What kind of farm?
Everything farm. It was, our main crop was sugar cane. which turned into hay. We had horses and pigs and cows and chickens and, I mean, you name it. And we ate everything on the farm. Fruit trees, pomegranates, we shelled pecans.
Oh, my God.
And then my parents lived in a little trailer in front of my grandparents' house. And all of my cousins, my dad's one of eight, all lived around us. We all, like, bought land together. I know. It was, like, so country, right?
What was the name of the town?
Well, Dusson or Scott, they're both, like, teeny, teeny, teeny towns, like, no paved roads. And, like, you know, you could drive your tractor to the gas station kind of place. But it's still, like, it's still that way.
It I was going to ask
changed.
You.
Nope. It has not changed one bit. I have a whole bunch of cousins that still live on that land.
Wow.
And some that moved into my grandparents' old house. I mean, it's definitely, it's a tight-knit, you know, kind of community. So that's still there. I was there till I was about eight.
So you have memories of childhood from there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. My brothers and I and our bikes driving down, you know, gravel roads and, you know, my brother's four-wheeling us to the grocery store and, oh, yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, I think, yeah, those core, like, memories of, you know, sharing a room together with my brothers when I was little and just, yeah, I remember all of it.
And you are one of how many kids?
I have two older brothers.
Okay.
Yeah, they're 5 and 7 years older than myself.
Okay.
And then we moved to Oklahoma.
Where in Oklahoma?
Duncan.
Okay, now what's that near?
If anybody is from Duncan, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. It was like, oh, we were only there for 3 years, but it was, that was torture. There's a Walmart, which we called Wally World. That was mm-hmm. the only place to hang out. And like two elementary schools and like a high school. It was a very, very, very small closed town.
So if you were there from like 8 until 11, those are really formative years. Those are
yeah.
tough, awkward years, no matter who you are or where you are.
Yep. Yes, they were. I had one like really good friend who was like my like little touchstone, and we kind of just, you know, went through life together, mm-hmm. just her and I, who we actually are still in touch. But so yeah, I was there for a couple of years.
Okay.
That's where I got into gymnastics and kind of started my arts love, I'd say.
I was going to ask you, what was the beginning of that? Was that in Louisiana? Was that in Houston? Where was that?
I did a little dance in Louisiana when you're little, but that's like, you know, when your parents put you in 25 activities and go, okay, let's see what you like. Mm-hmm. But gymnastics, when I was in Oklahoma, was a pretty serious sport. I mean, like Shannon Miller was one of our, her mom was one of our judges and her coach was one of our coaches. And my summers were spent going to Bella Caroli gymnastics camp.
Oh, wow.
And getting up at the crack of dawn and doing meets in the weekends. And so that was, you know, that was definitely part of my, a huge part of my life for many, many, many years.
It's a big deal down there in Texas and Louisiana.
Deal. It is a really big deal. Yeah.
What did you love about it at that age?
I mean, I think to this day, I like competition. I find it healthy and fun. And, I mean, I loved learning new skills and I loved the discipline that you get from it. I love to this day too, following rules. Like I love having a teacher, like I can't work out on my own. I need someone to tell me what to do. So I think that just is part of my personality. And I think, and you have to have a natural knack for gymnastics. It's a hard thing to like, just go, I'm just going to train enough. Like you kind of just have to have like random flexibility and, you know, there's certain strength. So I started that and got pretty far and level wise and competition wise. And then we moved to Texas.
Okay. So you moved to Houston at what age?
11.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are you at what age? You're tall. You're 5'7".
Yeah. But I was 4'11" till high school.
I was going to say, so how long were you able to compete as a gymnast? Cause you're really tall now.
Yeah. So when I was about 11, we moved to Texas and, I still like hadn't really grown. I think I maybe had hit like 4'11", I think by that time ish. Maybe I wasn't even that tall. I was really tiny. It's so funny to see my pictures and compare them to my little one who's 8, and we were the same size. Like I was so tiny at 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. But they do say, obviously, if you do a lot of gymnastics, it can stunt your growth, and that, you know, you do stay small for a while. It kind of suppresses a lot of that growth, unfortunately. But all of a sudden, I hit high school, and I was like 5'7", and I had giant boobs, and I was like, what's happening? What are these? But yeah, I had to stop. By the time I got to like 12, 13, I didn't have a life. I was like training and then at meets, and my mom would like bring me Tupperware meals of like dinner. And I just like, I didn't have like a social life. I didn't, outside of like just those people that I saw, you know, during training. So,
I guess you have to be that dedicated to it in order to be great at it. Like,
yeah.
I look at, like, my son's a hockey player and I skate sometimes still too. And the girls who are really hardcore figure skaters, like, they're homeschooled, mm-hmm. they're there all day.
Yep.
That's their entire life. And I guess you have to be that dedicated to that kind of sport if you really, really want to succeed.
Yeah. I think it was one of those things too, where I didn't see myself being like an Olympic gymnast. And I kind of felt like if we weren't going to go that route, I don't really need, there's other things I want to do. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do cheerleading and I wanted to run track and I wanted to, like, you know, just, I wanted to hang out. So yeah, it was time.
Okay. So you get to Houston, right?
Houston.
So what is bringing you guys to all these talents? Your dad's work, right?
My dad's work. My mom was a school teacher. She was a special education teacher for 27 years.
Wow.
Yeah, she has a lot of patience. And my dad worked for Halliburton. Mm-hmm. So he kind of, yeah, was moving up in the ladder and, that required us to move a bit. So,
and it makes sense that you were in those states, that part
towns.
Of the world.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, everyone that worked in Duncan pretty much worked for Halliburton.
Okay.
So,
and so then you moved to Katy.
Moved to Katy,
okay.
Texas.
So what is Katy like in the 90s, I guess it is, right? The early 90s.
Katy was like just expanding then. Houston was, you know, already kind of established, but Katy, like where we lived, they were starting to build. There was a lot of people moving in for oil, for the hospitals were getting built out there. And so they basically started building all these, you know, planned communities, which to my parents was like the greatest thing ever.
Why?
Because you, like, you drive into your little gated community. First of all, the homes in comparison to, you know, like LA or New York or a lot of other places are like cheap. Mm-hmm. Right. And you get this beautiful planned community and there's like a pool in the front for everyone. Everyone can just go to the pool for free and everyone can just go play at the 17 parks and you can go fishing in the pond. And I mean, it was like, it's like Stepford, but like a fraction of the cost. So I bought a house out there and, you know, it was very traditional Texas, like very much you went to church on Sunday and, you know, you were a cheerleader. And if you were a boy, you played football. It was very kind of, you know, it didn't have to be, but I would say the majority of Texas was very kind of traditional upbringing, which I loved.
Mm-hmm. The Friday Night Lights part of it is all true.
100%. I was a cheerleader for years through junior high and high school. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. I loved it. I mean, most of it. You know, it's Texas, so let's be honest. There's a little bit of racism there.
I was going to ask about that.
I like to gloss over that when I talk about how great my childhood was.
Because Katy wasn't a very black town, I'm guessing, back then.
You hit the nail on the head there. It was not. It was not. Especially not, yeah, in the 90s. I was there, I guess, I don't know, when did we move there? Like 91, 92, something around there. And no, they were like, you could count on your hand how many black people there were in the town, much less in the high school or the junior high. I guess it's so funny. Like I didn't realize it in junior high. I guess I just didn't see it, or in elementary school. I don't know why. And then once I got to high school, it was just apparent, like end of junior high, high school, it was apparent that I was different and that I could be the best black cheerleader. I could be the prettiest black girl. I could be the best black girl dancer, but I would never be just the best at anything without having to use that in front of it. And that's when I was like, oh, wow. Huh. And it wasn't even like I felt less than. I knew that I wasn't, but I started to see how they differentiated me from themselves, a lot of the kids in high school. And I was called the N-word and, you know, I know it's so funny because my husband's like, I never realized you went through all this.
Your husband is white, we should say.
My husband's white. He's white male from New York. So he was like, what? Racism. I still remember going to like the Sadie Hawkins dance, and I went with my boyfriend at the time. And we had, you know, it was like me and like a sea of white kids. You know, you go early and you take the little party bus and take pictures at someone's glorious mansion. And I remember taking pictures with him and then as a group, and they were kind of, his parents were kind of like taking pictures. But then as soon as the group pictures were done, they went and grabbed our friend Sarah Smith, who's the blondest, whitest, blue-eyed, most beautiful, sweet little angel. And they made her come and stand with him to take pictures because they couldn't send the pictures of me and him to their family members for the dance. So they like pretended like that's who he went with. And I was horrified, obviously. And then he was like, I really can't like date you. I've got like, my parents just aren't really, they don't approve. And
holy
and
shit.
And that was like probably my sophomore year of high school.
So you're like 15 at that point.
Maybe a little, I started high school at 13. So okay. I was a little bit young.
I was young too.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it was definitely like, that was a blow. I mean, you know, and then your eyes, you know, it's funny, we have kids obviously, and there's certain things that once they, once that innocence is lost, you know, you kind of like pull back the curtain on reality a little bit. I think that started to happen for me in high school, just that there was like no amount of, there's no amount of like wearing the right clothes or no amount of how wealthy you are or what house you live in or what car, there's no amount of any of that that could change the fact that when I walk in a room, I am a black woman and like, or a young girl or whatever. And you know, that's the skin I wear.
And how'd you deal with that emotionally?
You know, I guess like, thank God for my mom, 'cause she did not take any bullshit. And she just instilled in me that, you know, she was proud of herself, first of all, and not in an ego way. She had done a lot. She came from a little and she had done a lot. And she was really proud of herself. And my dad was really proud of her and they always said it. And so I guess I was kind of like, well, that sucks for them. I mean, to this day, if you have a problem with me because of that, that's your problem. And I kind of don't, of course, I mean, I'm sure there were moments that it hurt, but it was quick. It was quick.
And so as a teenager, even, did you think to yourself, I've got to get out of this place?
Like, 100%. Well, it's so funny because my junior year, and this was my deciding point, my junior year of high school, I was cheerleader. And the one girl that was going to be a senior that should have been head cheerleader, and this may sound trivial, but it's not, was not a great cheerleader, and nor was she a great leader. And she also, like, you know, got D's and C's and stuff. So our coach wanted to make me head cheerleader, which had never been done before. First of all, I was a junior. Second of all, I was black. And they were like, okay. So I get called into the principal's office with the girl that was supposed to be head cheerleader and with our coach. And they were like, so here's what we're going to do.
Oh no.
We're going to make you head cheerleader, but we're not going to tell anybody.
Oh, that's so screwed up.
That's so messed up, right? And also, they used to print these, if you live in Texas or in the South, you know, they print these long ribbons that you wear for homecoming.
Oh, yes.
And they have everyone's name on them.
The mums. Yes.
But there was also one that came out that was like, oh, for the whole school. It had every person's name that was like in football and cheerleading and head cheerleader. And it was all listed on this ribbon. It was like a really cool thing. You got them, you kept them. It was a keepsake. And they were like, so sorry, but we can't print your name on the ribbon. It would just upset too many people.
Oh my God.
And
I'm so angry for you retroactively.
And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Okay. Okay, fine. So I was head cheerleader my junior year, and then the opportunity to audition for that high school for performing and visual arts came up. And my dad was going to move to Caracas for a short time just to work for Halliburton there and then come back. And I was like, Dad, I don't want to stay in this school. You know, can we go with you? He was like, no, you can't. It's not really safe. And I said, well, if I get into HSPVA, can Mom and I move like downtown while you go to Caracas and we get to stay here? And he was like, yeah, if you get in, you can go and you guys can stay and I'll get you an apartment down there, you and your mom. You can do whatever you want. So I got into HSPVA and that changed my life. To be around every kind of person, every color person, every, you know, gay, straight, you know, trans kids already. Like, this is Texas in the 90s.
Yeah.
There were trans kids. And I was like, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know it existed. I didn't even know that you could, like, do this as a career, that there were, like, people that actually made money and weren't, like, living in, you know, shacks in New York with 17 people. I was like, oh, my God. And it changed my whole life that one year.
And didn't you look back and think, God, I wish I'd been here all this time?
The whole time. I know. I mean, but honestly though, just that one year was enough to, you know, change my whole trajectory. I had planned on being an OBGYN.
Oh, wow.
Going to Rice, being a doctor, staying in Texas. That's kind of, you know, what I had planned. And then that one year I was like, no, I'm not going to be a doctor. I'm going to do theater. and I'm going to go to this random school in Ohio. And, you know, if I get in, I'm going. And that's what happened.
You would have been an amazing doctor, though, by the way. You're so smart and you're so detail-oriented and you're also so warm and kind. Like, you could be a wonderful,
so
calming
sweet.
Force.
Oh.
I would let you examine me.
Oh, thank you. And I would gladly give birth to your baby.
Thank you so much.
Take him from you.
Thank you so much. So you go to the performing arts school for your senior year. Is that where the love of musical theater came from, or had it been in you already?
No, that's where it came from. I mean, and I was a dance major, so I danced, you know, after gymnastics kind of stopped, I had gotten into more of just the dancey gymnastics competition world. And so I danced there, but also just got exposed to musical theater. And, you know, they put on fabulous shows that were like, you know, Broadway, you know, these kids that were going to end up being, you know, big performers. So I think then it was more of just kind of wetting my whistle a little bit. And then we did, you know, they do those, like, the colleges come by and they kind of, you know, tell you what they do and give you their spiel. And instead of having, you know, Rice and UT and, you know, all these kind of traditional schools come by, you have, you know, North Carolina School of the Arts and Tisch and CCM and, you know, all these great art schools come in and kind of give you their spiel of what you could do. And you perform for them and they kind of see your work and then you go from there. And that's where I picked my university and where I kind of decided to apply. And it just kind of kept, I kept kind of just saying yes to stuff and going, okay, I'll try it. And it just kind of kept working out.
So before we get to college, I have to ask you about high school. Is it like Fame? Were you all dancing on the cafeteria tables and singing and dancing?
I'm not going to lie. It's a little like Fame. I'm for real. Like, I was like, is this real? Like, it really is. I mean, honestly, they just moved campuses. They just built this like fancy state-of-the-art campus. But the one we went to was like literally painted black and red and looked like a 80s hip hop video.
Amazing.
On the inside. It had like black and white checker floors. And yeah, there was a part of it where like you'd walk down the hall and there'd be people practicing the violin and there'd be a singing group over here and there'd be people doing a monologue over here. You know, we were dancers running around. You know, we did the rest of our day in a leotard. You know, we were in English lit in dance clothes.
That's amazing.
So yeah.
You found your place.
I found my place with all the like artsy weirdos and me. I was like, this is where I'm supposed to be. Mm-hmm. It was.
Okay. So then you go to the University of Cincinnati. Is that a really well-known performing arts school? I don't know.
Yeah. So University of Cincinnati has a program called CCM, which is the College Conservatory of Music. Sounds very fancy. Mm-hmm. And so I got in there for musical theater. And I would say, yeah, their musical theater program, there's like four of us that are kind of the, I don't know if you call them whatever, just well-known schools for that. There's Carnegie Mellon, which is great. There's like Boston Conservatory, Northwestern, and there's a lot more. But what they offer is very strategic, you know, kind of pathway classes to Broadway. And then the best part of it is your senior year, your like thesis is that you go to New York and you perform a 55-minute show for, you know, 200 agents and casting directors.
Amazing.
And it's part of your graduation. So none of us actually walked. We all went to New York together, performed. Then you sit on a stage with a piece of paper that has all the agents that have, or managers or whatever, that have circled your name to go and have a meeting with. And you call them and you set up meetings and you kind of just like, they hand you like the best chance of success right there.
That's so. Really smart for a walk of life that is creative and amorphous. Mm-hmm. To do something so linear and so strategic is really interesting.
It really is. I mean, I think one of the best classes I took was business skills for the actor. It's like your senior year.
Don't get taken by your agent.
Yeah. Like, I mean, or like how much money to save to move to New York, like how to network, where to go. And because it's such a small school, like my class only had 12 people and a lot of the classes have like between 15 and 16 kids. When you go to New York, you have a network of hundreds of people that have graduated before you that are just like waiting for the new kids to get there.
That's great.
Yeah. And they all come to showcase and you instantly, I moved in actually with, a guy that I had known that graduated years before I did. And we got an apartment together. So it just kind of gives you, you know, you're right in there with everybody else.
That's so great. So that's great. What is Cincinnati like? Are you actually like enjoying a city or are you just within the campus and that's your whole life?
Well, I was there during the Cincinnati riots.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
What happened there?
That was actually the kind of the beginning of what we're seeing, you know, in the last couple of years. But it was a young boy in an area called Over the Rhine, which is not a, it is now, but it was not a great area at the time. It was where like traffic was filmed. It was a lot of drug use, a lot of just poverty. But there was a young boy who the police officer said had a gun. He did not. And he was shot in the back.
Oh, man.
So there was a lot of rioting happening. And Cincinnati at the time, and I haven't been back in years, was a super racially divided city. And so we had a curfew. Everyone, the city had a curfew. 6 p.m. you had to be inside unless you were on your to or from school or to or from work, I think it was. And being, you know, in college, we were like, but we want to go out. So we would basically, and there were certain areas that you didn't want to drive at the time if you were white, because you just, it was just really, really, really bad. But all the gay bars in the like really awesome area that we went to, you had to drive to Over the Rhine. So I had my Honda Civic and I would put all my friends in the car and they'd duck down and I would drive us to like, you know, Hamburger Mary's for like drag bingo.
So you made it safe. You were the black girl.
How the tables have turned, Christy. How the tables have turned. Yeah, so we had that. And then that was like, I want to say like maybe my sophomore year and then my junior year, there was like another set of riots. It was a lot. But that being said, I kind of like our high school, it was like a band of misfits. We were all kind of a mess, but we didn't see anyone else but each other. We you know, got up at 7 a.m. and started with music theory. And then we performed and we did songs for the actor and we did, you know, on camera work. I mean, it was just nonstop. And we rehearsed on Sunday. So our weekends were really short. I mean, we were really with each other. We were very, very, very close. We're actually having a little mini reunion next month in New York. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I didn't get to do like go to football games and go to sorority stuff. And you kind of really weren't part of the university. It was really kind of a separate conservatory, of weirdos.
So you come in as a dancer, but you clearly have since developed singing and acting and every facet of being a performer. How did all of that go, coming from having one strength and learning the others?
I think what makes a wonderful dancer isn't always just skill. It's telling a story through your body. So I think you learn some bit of acting, you know, if you want to, in that form of art. And then I think singing, I always kind of sang a little bit, but I wasn't like a, I'm just a singer. And then acting wise, I really, that for me was all college. I mean, I had no idea what I was doing. I had some really fabulous acting teachers in college that I still, you know, to this day, thank them for all of my career. Richard Hess was my acting coach in college and we still chat a lot, but, yeah, they just, they find what you can do and teach you how to tell a story. And that's all it is. It's really not that complicated. It is, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I went in there obviously with the dance training and singing kind of was there and the acting I really had to, that's what I had to work on.
Mm-hmm.
And then you learn the rest, you learn as you go, to be honest. You know, you do a show and you watch other people and, you know, I would do a little acting gig and I would just watch. It was like, even when I did background, you know, those little jobs that you take when you first move to New York, if you just sit and watch and you see how it works, you can kind of, you can figure a lot out.
But I would guess that instinct to just watch would be kind of rare in a lot of performers who maybe are more egotistical or who are all about themselves and think they know everything. Like the instinct to be quiet and be still and observe and learn is it's a sign of humility, right? And so I would think that would be, not everyone would have necessarily that approach to it as you had.
Yeah. I mean, well, thank you. I don't know.
There's not really a question in there. It's just an observation.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
So you're sitting on the stage with all your list of people to see. You go off to New York. Yeah. What did that feel like to move to New York? That was the dream, right?
That was my dream. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I mean, by then I had visited New York quite a bit. Actually I'd spent a couple summers doing like Alvin Ailey summer programs and just visiting with my mom and I would take trips and, yeah, so by senior year, we were all ready. We all make the move. I got a fabulous, way overpriced New York apartment.
Where was it? What part of town?
I lived on 48th between Broadway and 8th in the Ritz Plaza.
Oh, my God. That's a really busy place.
Yep. And my roommate and I took a one-bedroom, which is this. Everybody does this. We took a one-bedroom. We put a wall in the living room, and we made it a two-bedroom.
Okay.
So I moved in with him, and I just kind of start. I mean, you really just start pounding the pavement. You have meetings. I think I did a couple of things on like Guiding Light, and then I met with Disney casting, and I auditioned, and I basically, what did I do before then? Did I do anything before then? I can't remember. I'm drawing a blank. I'll remember later.
It's okay.
And then I started Lion King.
Okay.
Basically right out of college.
Okay. So what was your role in The Lion King?
The Lion King.
Are you so excited for the movie coming out? The
I'm
new
so
version?
Excited. I want to not listen to musical theater in the car, and I try not to because the kids are like, Mom, but I do love it. I still like get so much joy from singing along. yes, I'm very excited.
Okay.
Yeah.
Your first role isn't that's a big deal to get in The Lion King on Broadway as like your first major role.
So I did not do Broadway. I did the first national tour.
Okay.
So it was the first one coming out.
But still.
But it was still very exciting.
Yes, yes.
I started the show I covered 22 specialties in the show, which made me nuts. Mm-hmm. And I danced the first act and sang the second act, which was super cool. I feel like I got to do everything in the show. And I think it's also really fun when you get to choose a show where it's like a rock concert. Like everyone that comes to, at that time, this was a million years ago, but it was still fresh and new. And everyone that got to see The Lion King was like the coolest thing ever. You know, it was their hot ticket of the season. It was their Christmas present, you know. And so you wanted to do a good show because these people were spending, you know, thousands, hundreds of dollars to come and see this elephant come down, you know, the thing or that zebra that you're wearing that day, you know, look like a zebra, you know. It was like, it was a big deal. There was a lot of like, you know, kind of good pressure on it. So I did that. I was a zebra. I was a lot of different things, but I covered Nala and Shinzi and Sarabi and puppets and, I mean, all kinds of stuff.
And I would guess, too, because this is like the late 90s at this point?
This was 2004?
Okay.
Three, four.
But there wasn't like the propensity for assholes in the crowd to be on their phones, for example,
no.
The way there is now,
we
right?
We did not have
smartphones
that.
Did not exist back
no.
then.
No, so it was like T9. Do you remember texting? Like, it took like seven presses to make one letter.
To make a question mark. So, but speaking to your point about how people were really psyched to be there and you were psyched to do it for them, it was a more intense communal experience back then, I would guess.
Sure. I mean, you know, and they still try really hard. You're not really supposed to bring your phones out. And, you know, if you ever go to a Broadway show and you see the ushers take their jobs very seriously. It is like, it's like a union thing and they are in it to win it. And they will cut your hand off if they see you holding a phone up to videotape.
And they should.
And they should because
it's rude.
The thing about live theater is that it's live.
Mm-hmm.
It's not meant to be. And that's why I think a lot of these, the ones that are made for TV, the live action ones are, there's a part of it that's really hard to capture. You know, on it just flattens when you have a camera in front of it. Not all of them, and they do great work, but there is something about sitting in a theater and feeling that either excitement, rush, happiness, sadness, whatever it is, just in that moment, and that's it. And when the curtain goes up at the end, it's over, and all you have to take is your memories. Like, we don't do that anymore. We don't like just go, I remember that time. We go, oh, hold on, let me show you on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
Let me show you that video. I took it. It's not the same.
That human connection.
Yeah.
You can't really replicate it.
Nope.
Interesting. So you're doing 8 shows a week. Are you exhausted at the end of it? Are you exhilarated? How does that feel?
I mean, yeah, you're exhausted. You have your moments because we don't get a lot of time off. I mean, your night off is Monday. Woo, woo. It's like not like a party night.
You're unless
like,
you're on Broadway.
To go to the bar. It's all Broadway people.
Right.
I mean, everyone that's there is like, it's, you know, you see the same people week after week. But like we just said, looking out and watching like someone weep during a song, or like looking out and having a tambourine in your hand and watching like some woman like dancing along in the audience with you with her shoulders. Like there's no matter how tired you are, there's no greater feeling. There really isn't. I mean, we could be exhausted on a Sunday night and go out there and do, you know, whatever, Catch Me If You Can, and run back to the dressing room and go, oh my God, did you see that girl in row six? Oh my God, did you see it? I mean, you can't replicate it. So, and the community of Broadway is just, it's like family. I mean, we are tight. We are a very tight knit, you know, you're getting changed in front of these people. You're seeing them way more than you see your family. Mm-hmm. So it's that community part of it is just unreal.
So you do The Lion King. Does Catch Me If You Can come next, or does the Hugh Jackman show come next?
No, I did The Lion King, and then I came back to New York for a little bit, did some stuff here, and then I did Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Ooh.
Oh.
Was that so fun?
Chitty chitty bang bang, we love you. It was fun. It was my first Broadway show. So it was like, you got to do all the things, you know, and you do the opening night party, and, you know, we've got a big flying car in the middle of the stage. My parents came in.
Oh,
and
awesome.
It was, you know, that was like a really, that was a big deal. It was really fun. And we had Gillian Lynn, who is our choreographer. I think she's still alive. She's like perpetually 95. Like, she's been like 85 for like 50 years, but she would bring us cases of wine during rehearsal. Like, here's how things are different on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Like, if you want to go out and have a cocktail with like your creatives in the middle of rehearsal, everyone's like, cool. Like, no, it's just a very just laid back, like kind of easy, fun world. So Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
So how was all of this compared to what your expectations of it might've been?
It was better.
Yeah.
It was better. I mean, you know, you weren't making tons of money, but that's not what you were there for. I mean, I think I cleared like $700 a week maybe. And, you know, in New York, that's tricky. That's tricky anywhere.
Far, yeah.
But, you know, it's not a ton of money. But, you know, I think this now too, if you can just remember that there are like millions of people that want to do what you're doing, whether it's TV or film or Broadway, you know, you're in this very special place. It's special. It's sacred, you know, and it should never be taken for granted because there's a million people behind you waiting, you know? And so I just like, every time I'd get something, I'd go, oh, wow, I did it again. Okay. Okay. It's working. Okay. Okay. So, it was better, you know, and you're tired and you're like, oh God, but you know, you're like, I do this show. I want to go to brunch and I want to go on vacation. And, but all that is, that would be in any job, you know? I think you have to remember how special it is.
You have to have that work ethic and that discipline to make it that far and stay there.
Yeah.
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 So let's talk about Hugh Jackman.
Hugh.
Was he wonderful?
He's wonderful.
So what was the show you did with him? Describe the show.
I did a show called Hugh Jackman Back on Broadway. And it was basically Hugh, it was like I would say a one-man show, but obviously there were women in it. There were five of us. And it was kind of him doing the best of Hugh Jackman. So he did a little bit from Boy from Oz. He did some standards. He did this whole thing where he played the, you know, didgeridoo.
Oh my God.
With his son, and this beautiful, you know, kind of montage of photography came up. He really did everything. He tap danced. It was, you know, that was a rock concert. I mean, if there's such a thing, you know, there are people that he's got these group of women that travel literally all over the world to see him. And they came like three times a night. I don't know how they afforded it. It was like beyond, I don't even know. But he's lovely. He's just a wonderful human being and giving. And, you know, one of his favorite things to do is by day, like three or four, he knows everyone's name, like crew,
wow,
door guys, you know, makeup, hair, costume, everyone's name. It's like a mental thing that he feels like everyone knows my name. Everybody knows my name as soon as I walk in. But it's just as important for me to make the effort to know their name. And he was wonderful, down to earth.
That says a lot about him. Yeah. That mattered to him.
It does. It does. Yeah.
I interviewed Hugh Jackman. Gosh, what year was it that Van Helsing came out? Were you working with him at that point?
No, I think that was before, I want to say.
I'll look it up on IMDb while I'm talking to you.
That was, I did that show with him in 2010,
okay.
I want to say.
Oh yeah, this is definitely before.
Really little.
Van Helsing was 2004. Hugh Jackman, Kate Beckinsale. Not one of his better movies, but I had the pleasure of, I interviewed him in his hotel room. It was like junket day, crazy junket day where, you know, you're just cramming in 5-minute interviews. So I sat with him in his hotel room while he had lunch and I interviewed him there.
Cool.
And he was just like, yeah, generous. He has that thing, that star thing,
totally.
But he couldn't have been nicer. And he, you know, he seemed to not have really any ego. And I went and watched him do Boy from Oz. And, you know, he's just, he's charismatic as hell. And he works his ass off.
Yeah. No, he does not stop. I mean, we were in rehearsal. No, we were doing the show and he was training for the next, what's the?
X-Men?
X-Men movie.
He's Wolverine.
What's the one that came out with the little girl, though?
Logan.
Mm-hmm. Logan or one of them. Anyway, he's training for that. So he's like doing the show, but he's dancing so much, he's losing weight. So he would train in between shows or after the shows or on the weekends. And he would eat like massive amounts of food because he was trying to get his weight back up so that he could build, you know, that muscle. He has that unfortunate skill of just being thin naturally.
Yeah.
I know, it's just terrible. It's a horrible champagne problem. No, but he does. He's the hardest working man I've ever seen. So,
So around this time, at what point do you get the gig on Major Crimes that brings you out to LA?
So after Hugh Jackman, cause that was like a limited run, I did, Anything Goes.
Okay.
With Sutton Foster.
How fun.
It was really fun. It's an 8-minute tap number. You know,
it sounds tiring. It sounds hard to tap dance for 8 minutes straight.
You know, it was not easy. It's not one of my easiest numbers. So I was doing that show and, I got, you know, an audition for this and I kind of was like, I remember reading it and thinking, I'm going to get this. I'm going to do this. What do I need to do? I'm going to make this, I'm going to will it to happen. And, obviously, you know, it took a whole bunch of other people to make this happen, but, I was in the middle of that show and, I auditioned in New York. I tested in New York. They were very generous to let me do that. And then I got a phone call for what I thought was a callback in LA, but they were going to fly me out to LA. So they fly me out to LA. I'm freaking out. My husband's already here cause he's here for like a thing for work. And, I wear my audition outfit cause I'm a nerd. Cause I think, I don't know what to do. What am I doing? They're like, oh, well, we have a car coming to pick you up. But like, no one's really telling me what's going on. So I'm at the hotel, a car picks me up and I have my sides in my purse. I'm wearing my audition outfit still.
Which is what? What's your outfit?
I have on like a black, like kind of loose tank top that I still have, a pair of like tight, you know, jeans and like military boots. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll be ready, you know, for whatever they need. So I get in the car and it's driving. I've never been to LA. And
this is your first time in LA?
First time in LA.
Oh my gosh.
I get out at Campanile, the restaurant.
Oh yeah, on La Brea.
Yeah. So I get out there. I'm like, okay, I guess we're going to eat lunch. So I get out and we sit down and have lunch. And it's the creator of our show and our executive producer. And James Duff and Mike Robin. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, I'm ready. Like, you know, what do you need to see anything? And they're like, no, we just flew you out here to tell you that we, you know, or ask you if you'd like to join our family.
Oh,
and
my God.
I was like, seriously? Like, is this what they do in Hollywood? I'm like, I'm wearing my audition outfit and my sides are in my purse,
which
they still like, they still love to hear the story. So they literally flew me out here, put me up, drove me to lunch, and just to tell me I, you know, got a job. And that is basically, that shows who they are and still are to this day. They're just the most generous, humble, like just good human being. So, and that was it. And we moved here like a month later.
So we should back up a little bit. Cause at this point that you get this job on Major Crimes, you're married and you have two kids.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I somehow mixed that into 10 years of Broadway.
I don't know how you had two kids and still like danced and had these crazy hours on Broadway. How did you do that? Cause they were little, your babies were little then.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. Like no one told me no. Like no one was like, you know, you can't do that. And also like a lot of people do it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like I was the first one or the last one. So I think when I had Jordan, my first one, I stopped doing a show and like we got pregnant and, you know, kind of that was the trajectory. But I went back to a show. I went back. I did Catch Me If You Can when she was 3 months old. I went back to work. So
you got out of that baby weight.
You don't have a choice, honey. I did pre-pro and they were like, here's your unitard. But you bounce back because you're working so hard.
And you were young when you had Jordan.
I was so young.
You were 26?
26.
Okay.
Yeah. So I had her. And then when I got pregnant with Peyton, I was already in a show.
Okay.
So I stayed in that show. If you could see pictures of how big I was, they were so kind that they made me like modesty panels.
Which show?
I was doing Finian's Rainbow.
Okay.
Which I stayed in until I was like 6 months pregnant. And I wasn't like big. You couldn't really tell on the bottom, but can I say tits?
Of course you can. You can say fuck. You can say shit.
My tits were so big. I was wearing a G. I don't even know if you know how big a G is. A G is like literally the size of a basketball, but you're carrying it on your chest.
They were a porn star.
I was a porn star dancing on Broadway. So I had these like, and it was like such a beautiful like Irish musical. I was supposed to be like demure. And here I am like in this giant, got like a belly and giant tits. So they would like add fabric at the top to make me like an extra like, boulder holder.
Wow.
So finally I was like, okay, that's it. I can't do cartwheels anymore. So I stopped that show. And then, yeah, I mean, I didn't take that much time off. I kind of had them and bounced right back. Because the beauty of Broadway, though, is that you do a show at night. So when they're little, you're gone all night, but they're sleeping. And during the day, you're home all day long. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's great when they're little. It's not so great when they get a little older and they're in school. That gets complicated. But when they're little, it's kind of perfect.
So your husband, Phil, who's the loveliest guy, by the way, we should mention really fast. He's so sweet and
so
decent
sweet.
To his core and has like this really understated sense of humor. He's just a wonderful guy. And we've loved hanging out with you guys.
Yeah.
So he's a New Yorker though. Mm-hmm. So when you tell him, hey, I got this job on Major Crimes and like, we should all move out to LA for it. What's his reaction?
Well, I first phrased it as, if I get this job, can we move? And funny, at that time, we were kind of ready to leave the city and move out to the suburbs. We were going to move to Montclair, New Jersey. The girls were already in preschool out there. We had, you know, enrolled. And so we kind of were ready for a change. And he has an office out here, too. He can work bi-coastally. So he said, well, you know, let me check out some, like, stuff and see if that's possible. And at the time, our nanny, Sonia, I said, if we move to LA, will you come with us? And she said, yeah, I'll come with you for like 6 months to a year and help you settle in. And, so once everyone said yes, I think I got it like in February or March maybe. And we moved, March, and we moved here April 7th.
And then I met you right around then.
Yeah.
Like you had just moved to LA.
Yeah, because the producer, Mike Robin, actually the same wonderful man who flew me out here. He was the reason we got into Hollywood Schoolhouse.
Okay.
Because we came mid-year.
Okay.
And we were like, what do we do? I don't know. What do we do? And so he was like, I gotcha.
So his kids had gone there?
No. He just knew some people there. It's like
okay.
LA, right?
LA.
I know a guy, right?
So at the finest LA private schools.
He knew a guy. It's so funny because like side story, when we first like got into Hollywood Schoolhouse, my husband's parents came to visit. And so we go to take the girls into school and they hop out of the car. And his mom, who's like the sweetest, like very Italian, her name is Concetta and they're from Long Island. She gets out. She goes, oh my God, is that Al Pacino? And of course,
yes.
It's Al Pacino.
Yes, it is. we had some celebrity parents at our school.
She was like, oh my goodness. Like her mind was blown. Like that's who our kids were going to school with. So
what was LA like compared to your expectations of it, having never lived in LA before?
You know, it's LA is what you make of it. You know, I think you can make it that LA scene, but you have to look for it. You know what I mean? Like, it's not just going to hit you in the face. You can also just, like, go to the beach and be a, you know, really down kind of, you know, calming place, too. I don't know. LA, I didn't really have any preconceived notions about it, to be honest. I think moving here with a family, you don't really, there's a choice that you don't really have. You kind of just have to, like, you got kids, you got stuff to do. There's, like, you got your mom friends, you got, you know, soccer. And so it kind of forces you into a certain place in LA. I mean, I think there's definitely assholes here, you know, obviously.
Like they're everywhere.
Duh. But they're everywhere and they're in every business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would say that the one thing, like I go back to New York and no one wears makeup or heels during the day. And I come back here and I'm like, oh, gosh, I'm wearing heels and I have makeup on and it's like 1 in the afternoon. Like those are differences that I think are just, that's just city. That's just how they are. You know, mm-hmm. New York, you're schlepping around all day long, and LA, you get in your car to go 3.5 miles to your friend's house to do a podcast and you put on makeup and maybe a clog, you know, it's just like who we are. You kind of like fall in line, but I love LA. I mean, I don't know. What about you? Do you love LA?
Well, I'm from here. So yeah, but that's why I say I'm pleased to hear that you like LA, because I think a lot of folks, especially if you are from New York or have lived in New York, there are all these expectations of that it's plastic and opportunistic and everyone is false and everybody wants something from you. And again, that exists in any city, any industry.
Any large city, yeah.
Right. And so I grew up here in the Valley, went away to school in Dallas at SMU, mm-hmm. and then lived in, you know, the Bay Area and New York, but came home. And so I'm always pleased when folks live elsewhere and then come to LA and really love it and find that it defies the stereotypes that plague it.
Sure. You know? I mean, like you said, that's any large city, any business. I would say that it's, and my husband's probably noticed this more than anyone else because he is in finance and, you know, didn't really have anything to do with entertainment business. And being out here, you realize that even if you're in finance, you're kind of in the entertainment business, mm-hmm. because your clients will inevitably, you know, the main industry here, big and small, whether you're a lawyer or whatever, is entertainment. You know, if you're a plastic surgeon, you're probably working on actors. If you're, you know, a lawyer, you might be doing entertainment law. You know, there's definitely, it breeds into a lot of other jobs out here.
And even folks that you meet elsewhere, like on your soccer team or your hockey team, like one of the dads on Nick's hockey team is, you know, a writer on Grace and Frankie. You know,
oh, totally.
Everyone works in this business, and his wife does fertility for, you know, celebrities.
Sure.
And so anyway, so it's everywhere. So you get Major Crimes. We should say what Major Crimes is. It was a spinoff of The Closer.
Yep.
And so you were one of the few new cast members into a family that was like well established and yeah. really beloved.
Yep.
What was that like?
Great. And I think because it trickles down, you have Mike and you have James, and there was no other option than for them to be warm and welcoming. I mean, that's just, they picked people that are those kind of people that you walk in and they're like, come over here. This is where we have lunch. Here, do you want a coffee? Here, you know, let's all go out and, you know, really get to know each other. And so it was never anything but wonderful, honestly.
That's great.
6 years of bliss, and we still, I mean, I just saw Kata last night, who played Hobbs. Our kids go to school together. and it's not fake. I mean, we really were, and sometimes dysfunctional. I mean, because, you know, when you're with people 16 hours a day, Monday through Friday, it's like brothers and sisters at some point, and you're like, I really just need you to walk away right now. But, you know, to be fair, our job wasn't that hard. It was wonderful. And we got to do great storytelling. We did it in LA, which a lot of people don't get to do. I mean, they're going to Vancouver and New Orleans and wherever. We were all based here.
You could see your family at
night.
You
know, you see your family. We lived a mile from work. I mean, it was really a wonderful gig, and they made it that way. Everyone did. It was a family, and we're still really close. I'm going to see some of them tonight for dinner.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we miss each other.
Aww.
We do.
Who was your character? Amy Sykes. Who was she?
Amy Sykes. She was an ex-military fighter and then turned into detective, kind of worked her way up through the ranks very quickly. She was very ambitious. I always like to say she was the girl with her hand up in class every time, mm-hmm. Which was annoying, but also she knew what she wanted. And she grew over the years. You know, she started very kind of young and innocent and made some mistakes, and then, you know, she grew, she got a little craftier, a little smarter, kind of held her own by the end. And I was really proud of her. And I was proud of the way that she was written. I love that James made her not a stereotype. I think that's so easy.
In terms of what kind of stereotype?
Easy way out. She was a really tough, strong woman, and that was it. And she had nuance and she had, you know, a lot of other qualities in her, but none of it was like, okay, so we want you to be sassy or we want you to like have your tits out or we want you to be like traditional, like, you know, like shake your finger, like, ooh, yeah, child. Like if I see one more audition where it's like, you know, sassy black woman like this. And I'm not saying we don't exist, but there's all types. There's all types of us. And to have this white gay man from Texas be writing this, you know, I was like, all right, that's pretty, that doesn't happen very often. So I was really proud that she was just a woman. She was, you know, she had her own battles and her own struggles and her own successes. And that's what it was. Mm-hmm. That's where it began. And that's where it ended.
I was going to ask you at some point, I do want to talk about auditions and is there more of an openness to consider actresses of all colors for every kind of role? I want to get to that at some point. So let's talk about that. But I don't want to lose track of this. What were the fans like? Because they had loved The Closer. Did they also love Major Crimes? Were they intense and great? And you know.
They did. Mm-hmm. They did. And I think that still plays into how James wrote her. I mean, I think he made her annoying in the beginning, but he gave this really great relationship with Provenza and her where, you know, she irritated him, but it was like having a daughter. You know, he wanted to show her the ropes, but he wanted to give her just enough rope to hang herself. You know, like, it was a really great, and because he's so beloved, GW was, I think that made the fans fall in love with her. You know, it was very manipulative, but in the right way. And I never got, you know, anything other than from the fans that they loved having, you know, Sykes is a great addition. And I really did. I felt a lot of love from them. And there's still, you know, there's still many Major Crimes fan pages of, you know, we miss you. And they're still supportive. And they still try to, you know, find out what we're all doing and keep in touch. So it was great.
It's on reruns, right? It's on TNT on reruns still?
We're streaming somewhere? I know The Closer is. Mm-hmm. We're waiting on the Major Crimes of it all because I would love that because I get residuals.
Oh, yes. We need that.
We need those. Those keep us afloat
while we're
auditioning.
Go to the grocery store, yes. So then you've done parts here and there. You did some Dynasty. Mm-hmm. You did some Bowl.
Mm-hmm. Some Designated Survivor. Okay.
But now, then the latest thing, though, was Black Lightning.
Yeah.
Now, describe to the world what Black Lightning is.
Okay. So Black Lightning is, it's on the CW. It's a DC comic book. It actually is based on a real comic book, and all the characters that we have are. And it is set in Freeland, which is not a real place, but is supposed to kind of be Atlanta, I would say, or just an urban city. And obviously you have your superhero and his family. His daughters are actually superheroes too. Cause that, you know, that's how it works.
It's genetic.
It's just like passed on. But the beauty of Black Lightning is that it's not just a superhero show and it's not just a family show. They take so much, out of, you know, what's really going on in our country and put it into the show. You know, I'm not going to say that it's all about, you know, Me Too and All Lives Matter, you know, that whole thing. But there is something more than just a show. You know, it's more than just, you'll have to watch and see. I'm not saying it correctly, but it's the meanings behind why it's written the way it's written are much bigger than just a superhero trying to fight crime. Is he fighting crime? Is he fighting society? You know, is his daughter in love with this man? Is it just a kid relationship or is it something more? I mean, I think that everything in it has some sort of double meaning. And I find that fascinating about the show. And I think it's easy to watch it and just see the surface level of it all, but it's so much more.
I think that's true of a lot of comic books, though. They're trying to tell a deeper allegorical story there, and they make it accessible through the colorful nature of it and all that. Did you know very much about this comic beforehand?
I did not. Luckily, there was a guy on the show whose name I'm forgetting, but he kind of was our backstory guy, and he was the one that brought us all the comics, and then we had the writer of the comic actually come for the last couple episodes, who I think maybe guest starring next year, which would be super cool. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know much about him, and actually Cutter is a man, Oh. She's like a crazy serial killer man with blades like all over his head and stuff. And so they took a lot of liberties in changing a lot of the sex and things of a lot of different characters.
That's amazing. Yeah. So your character was a man.
Yeah.
And they made her a woman.
They made her a woman.
Okay, so who is she?
So Cutter is, you know, she's a tracker. She's a skilled killer. She's got, she uses mostly blades and knives, but has been known to use a gun. And she is scarred, obviously. She's not a perfect person. Mostly by men is what we think. She's now in a relationship with, was until I won't ruin it for you.
But no, the last episode is aired.
No, it's aired. Okay. Yes.
The season finale aired on Monday.
Right. Yes. So she was in a relationship. We'll see what happens next.
Okay.
Next year. But she, you know, she works, with, Tobias,
the villain.
Whoa. Hold on. Let me have a sip of coffee.
It's been a long day of questioning. I've been interrogating you.
No, it's fine. I love it. It's like it's daily. She works with Tobias. But I think, you know, obviously they had a relationship past, didn't go well. He has broken her heart many times and she somehow keeps coming back for more like a lot of women do. Why do we do that, guys? Mm-hmm. Why do we do that? So I've had a great time playing her. I've always wanted to play a superhero. I feel like I've been putting it out into the universe for years, and the universe was like, okay, supervillain. Okay, fine.
She's such a badass. It's so fun to watch your transformation because you guys, if you've never seen the show, Kieran gets to wear like a nose ring and like this awesome mohawk, like braided hairdo thing. And like these really sexy, it's like dominatrix gear that you're in. It's like leather vests that are like pushing up your boobs.
I know.
It's like, damn, it's sexy. And it's a totally different kind of role for you. Is that just so thrilling to have that kind of departure?
Oh my gosh. It's exactly what I was looking for. I mean, I usually play, obviously, you know, very straight-laced, buttoned-up detectives, lawyers, doctors kind of thing. And I've wanted to do this so badly. So, yeah, when they gave me my, like, push-up bra with my, I call them chicken cutlets because they look like clear, like, chicken breasts to put underneath, I was like, yeah, yes, yeah, like, give it all to me. I love it. Our costume designer, Rebecca Gregg, is amazing. Who gets to get hard? And they let me do all my stunts.
I was going to ask you, like, how physically arduous is it? Because it's a lot of, like, serious fight scenes, like long choreographed fight scenes, and it's like flipping through the air and stuff. So you get to use all that physicality that you've had in you your whole life in this role.
It couldn't have been a better like marriage. It's funny because when I auditioned for the show, they were like, okay, so do the scene, but then do like some tricks afterwards, like whatever you can do. And so I was like, okay, I still take gymnastics. So I did my scene and then I did, you know, like some aerials and back handsprings and stuff and kicks and things. And so going in to my stunt rehearsals, they're like, well, we saw the video, so like do whatever you want. And they're wonderful. I mean, they choreograph everything, but it is really nice to be able to do it yourself. And our stunt people are amazing. Like, I don't fly through windows. Like, I ain't like going through glass. That's totally on you. But as far as like all the flips and stunt and the fights and knives and things like that, I've gotten to do. It's so cool. No, it's so cool. Like,
that
honestly, I'm
fun.
Like, some people are sitting at a desk right now. I'm going to harness up and do some backflips with some knives. It's pretty cool.
That sounds so fun. It just like, I just had the biggest smile on my face watching you do that. I watched the season finale.
Yay.
I'm like, how cool that like she gets to do this badass stuff.
Yeah.
So by the time this comes out next week, and so by the time everyone hears this, like the season finale will have been over.
Right.
Your character has walked out the door.
Yeah.
Is she going to come back for season 3?
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
Because, you know, I'm recurring on the show. I'm not a regular. Mm-hmm. It shoots in Atlanta as well. So they have, you know, tiptoed lightly and asked if I would like to come back or if I'm happy there. I'm truly happy there. I've had a wonderful time. Everyone's great. I would happily go back. I know that I'm not dead, which is good.
Right? No, exactly.
Although it seems to not matter because everyone comes back to life on that show. Like, I mean, I feel like everyone has killed the preacher like 5 times. Like, I killed him and somehow he's still back.
They have fire and lightning coursing through their veins.
It's amazing. I know.
It regenerates them.
Listen, whatever. It's TV. So we'll see.
Okay.
I mean, no one has told me. And I do know that they start the 3rd season in June. Mm-hmm. So I would say probably in the next 2 months or so, I should know.
Well, I hope
what's
so.
Going on. I hope
it
so,
seems
yeah.
really cool. We should also mention that it's really unusual in that it is a predominantly black cast.
Yes.
Black Lightning is a black superhero.
Yes.
What has that been like to be a part of that kind of show?
You know, I'm proud. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of this. First of all, we're on like a mainstream network, which is super cool. You know, just to be blanketed between all these, you know, just mainstream shows, I think is showing the steps that are really being taken in our business. And it's, yeah, I'm proud to look around and see everyone look like me, because most of the times, whether it be Broadway or TV, you know, you look around and it's you and everybody else. And, you know, it's different. It almost takes getting used to. I'm like, well, there's so many of them. It's amazing. And you know, it shows the talent that we have out there. Everyone on the show is phenomenal. All of our guest stars are, I mean, they're cream of the crop. And it's nice to see that, you know, we can hold down an entire show, an entire cast, and get great numbers and, you know, do a great show. Mm-hmm.
So I want to get back to a topic we touched on a little bit earlier. And that is, as far as auditions, you know, with something like Black Panther, with something like Black Lightning, are you seeing that you are now gaining the opportunity to go up for different kinds of roles for which perhaps they might not have envisioned a Black actress playing them? Or is it still baby steps toward that kind of open-minded inclusiveness in the casting process?
You know, I want to say that it's changed a ton and it's gotten better. I mean, I'm sure I'll get pushback for this. I feel like we've taken baby steps, which is good. It's good. And I think what's really being heard is, you know, Black filmmakers and producers and directors all kind of creating their own projects and making it happen themselves, you know, like Lena Waithe and Ava DuVernay mm-hmm. and Shonda Rhimes kind of saying, you know what, I'm going to just do it. I'm going to do it myself. And those are mostly producers and directors and kind of a different category of our business. I would say as an actress, I still think that the mainstream TV world, your network TV, I think a lot of that still has a little ways to go. And I think it also has to do with where those networks are broadcast and what people want to see. I mean, they're not making money. So what they're doing is, it's working analytically. Clearly it's working, but, I do feel like it goes in waves too. I mean, I feel like with everything that happened last year and, you know, we were really kind of moving forward, and you saw that in pilot season, you saw it in a lot of the shows that were coming out. And I feel like with anything else in our business, there's a whole bunch of brouhaha that happens and everyone's on social media and everyone's like hashtagging everything, right? Yeah. And then like 6 months later, they're like, oh, what was that? Like it dies so quickly. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I do feel like it's opened up certain things. I'll go in for things now that say, you know, all ethnicities or, you know, that kind of thing. And sometimes it works out and it's great. And sometimes, you know, it's out of just because they have to or just because they're willing to see. And oftentimes it still is not one of us, you know, whether it's Black or Asian or Spanish or whatever it may be. We're getting there. I think we're getting there. It's going to be baby steps. But I do feel like I said, the stuff that's getting created by, you know, minorities is amazing work. And it's all of us. And it's nice to look around and see that. So just, yeah.
You have hope.
I have a lot of hope.
Okay.
I'm old on the inside, but I'm young on the outside. I got a lot of ways to go. So.
You are amazing. What is still out there for you? What kind of character do you still want to play? Who do you still want to work with? Like, what is the dream that's still out there waiting for you?
You know, I did a pilot last season for NBC called Suspicion with Derek Luke. And that is what I'm waiting for. Not that pilot in particular, but obviously didn't get picked up, but, it's okay. It was a wonderful experience, but I'm waiting for a show. And I would compare it to almost This Is Us, not the content of the show, but just more shows and characters that are just people, you know, that have a story to tell. And I got to play a woman who just had her own story to tell and her emotions to be seen and her words to be heard. And that was really nice. It was nice. I was a wife or a fiance. I was a, you know, and they had their own struggles, and the story to be told was about a family and about this woman and about their struggles. And I would love to play something like that. That's really emotionally kind of right on the pulse. And, just a human.
Once you've gotten your superhero villain out of you, you want to play a regular person who has her own superpowers.
Right. Yeah, she's a woman. That's a superpower. So, we'll see.
Well, you are amazing. I'm so happy to get an hour plus here with you to talk to you. It zipped by.
No, it did. My dad's in town. I should go find him. He's probably wondering where I am.
Well, let's go find your dad. Kieran, thank you so much for coming over and hanging out with me. It's such a pleasure to let me pick your brain and explore your amazing career and just how inspiring you are. You make it all look effortless. You work your ass off and you're an amazing mom and a great friend.
So are you. Thank you.
So you spin all the plates beautifully.
Oh my God. Well, we're trying, right? You're doing the same thing. We don't even realize it's work. And then all of a sudden we sit down at the end of the day and we're like, oh, wait a minute. We did that.
We did everything.
We did that.
It's good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to see you too.
And we'll do more of these. Next week we have Phil Johnston, Academy Award nominated writer director of Ralph Breaks the Internet. He also wrote Zootopia and the first Wreck-It Ralph. He's also a very old friend of mine. So we'll talk to him next week, but thank you all for listening. Bye.